Well, I was of many minds with what to do tonight. I don't know who taught last week. Who taught last week? Can someone tell me who taught last week? No?
It was Kim Allen.
Oh, Kim. Okay. So, and it was Sunday night, and did you guys at all discuss what was happening in the Middle East on Sunday night?
No, hadn't really happened yet.
Really? Gee, I think it was Sunday night. Oh, but in any event, I'm imagining that it's possible some of you may have had a very difficult week. And like so many people, I think what I'd like to do, since this situation calls on Buddhist practitioners to do very specific things that are super hard to do in general, but really hard to do in this particular incendiary situation. I thought I would like maybe to begin by first allowing some dialogue to happen, because I have no idea whether or not some of you have had a chance to say something about how you've been either practicing during this time or how this has been difficult for you, and you maybe would like some help with how to practice with a situation that is so just unbelievably desperate and extreme on all sides. So I thought I would start by just like opening this up and, with a set of rules. The rules basically are we're practitioners and we are Buddhists, and therefore non-harming is our primary goal and it's our primary aspiration. And non-harming means we bring a quality of open-heartedness and clarity to whatever may arise. So I think what I'm hoping to have happen is to create a set of conditions where there's an openness here that there really isn't very much anywhere right now. It's almost impossible to have dialogue, probably in even in one's family. So anyway, I thought I would start by just opening it up and see if anyone has anything they'd like to share. Okay, Patty, absolutely. So.
Thank you, Lisa. I have friends and cousins in Israel, and it's been a very hard week. And the teacher, Oren Sofer, sent an email out that spoke for me. He said it so eloquently, and he said it so accurately, and he expressed his anguish so well that I wrote back to him. I never comment on those kinds of emails, but I wrote back to him and said, "Thank you for saying what I'm feeling." And it was basically a heartfelt description of anguish and fear and sadness. And he said it better than I could, but I was grateful that he put that in writing. And I've been sending metta to everybody in the Middle East and everybody in Ukraine and everybody in the world who's suffering from political cruelty and political upset. And I've kept the circle of metta for the people more close to me here who are suffering from physical ailments and emotional ailments and every other kind of dukkha. But there's so much dukkha that I feel like I can't do anything but send metta. So all of my practicing has been metta-focused. And I don't think it helps the situation, but it helps me. It helps me feel like I'm doing something. Even, the two songs that keep going through my head are Let There Be Peace on Earth and Let It Begin With Me. And also a song I remember from junior high school called Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream, about the world had all agreed to put an end to war. And those two songs keep coming into my head when I'm not doing the metaphrases, I'm thinking the lyrics to those songs. And it sort of soothes me a little bit, but I'm still in a default position of anguish. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Jerome?
I have my video off because I'm lying down and it's dark in here. I wouldn't be able to be seen much. My heart is broken for the Israelis and the Palestinians and the Gazans. My brother has lived in Jerusalem for, I think, 42 years. And he raised his family there. He's 73, and he's my little brother, and his wife is Sue, and he has four children. His only son, Shai, is a major in the reserves, and he's camping out at his base, and he has 14 grandchildren. And I think they're fortunate to live in Jerusalem and Beersheba rather than close to the north border or the border with Gaza. But their houses in Gilo, just if you walk up the hill from his house, you'll find you're looking down at the wall separating Israel from Palestine. So if there were bombs coming from there, he'd be right in the center of it, but luckily they're not. And I think besides setting Metta and Karuna his way and his family's way, the only thing I can do is to call them every day, make sure everybody's safe, make sure that they're still alive and well. And one of my nephews is a fireman, so he's in Jerusalem though, so he's not really at the front line fighting fires. But maybe he will have to do that at some point. So it's very tenuous for my family and for all Israelis and for all Palestinians and for all Gazans. And I just am aware of what Gabor Mate says about the conflict there, and that the Jews are not without guilt in terms of how they treated the Palestinians. And Hamas was supposed to be their substitution for the PLO, but it turns out that they're much worse than the PLO, at least in what I know. So I think there's wrong on both sides, and I don't condone the violence in either direction, but I fear for my family. And my daughter was supposed to take her husband to Israel to meet my brother and his family, and it doesn't look like they're going to be able to do that now. So I appreciate your offering this space for me to share this, because it's a difficult situation. And I'm very grateful to you and the Sangha to let me express what's happening. Jerome bowing out.
Thank you so much, Jerome. Thank you. Anybody else? I think I saw Janine raise her hand for a second. Well, there are so many ways we can use this situation to awaken, because, and I know you've all heard this before, suffering is the cause of awakening. It's sad that the level of suffering has to become this extreme. And yet, the one thing that the Buddhist path offers is the capacity and a skill set for doing what is sometimes called turning the jewel of the mind. It doesn't take a lot to turn the jewel of the mind. It can be a very small shift in view. So one of the things that the Buddha was very known for saying is all views are equally distorted. Just by virtue of being a view, all views have some distortion in them. Some of you may know about the 10 fetters. And even though there are 10, really, it's just the first three that are the meatiest. And if you can grapple with those first three, the view can be turned such that there's a capacity to recognize wisdom within the most unwise set of circumstances. So the first of the 10 fetters you all know, and that is fixation on self and distorted views of self. In the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, this is called self-cherishing. So it's a way of maintaining oneself at the center of everything. And I think what has happened, certainly over the last week, but happened over and over and over again in the Middle East, is self-fixation has been a cause over and over again of losing the view of selflessness. And this is the first fetter, fixation on distorted notions of self. Most particularly, the number one distorted notion of self, which is the subject-object dualistic view that anything has a separate self-existence from anything else. And I know I have gone here before with all of you, and I'll say it again. This is not like oneness, meaning everything is one. This is oneness, meaning nothing exists from its own side by itself. All causes and conditions, all existent phenomena exist in concert with all other existent phenomena. It all arises, exists, and passes away simultaneously in such a way, honestly, we really don't perceive this, but this is the nature of the way things are, even though human perception doesn't have the capacity to perceive the arising, existing, and passing away of phenomena in nanoseconds. We just can't do it. But this is the way it is. And the idea that any decision that could be made on either side in the Middle East, that would not include the other side in the Middle East, is false view. This is distorted view. And honestly, this is the core of non-harming. When one has this view of the utter interdependent co-arising of all phenomena, the innate capacity for all things to touch everything else, and the lack of separation, it is really almost impossible to harm at all anything. The second fetter is the arising of fixation on cultural conditioning. Yeah, the Buddha was a big fan of, you really need to let go of what your family told you, your nation told you, your religion told you, your media tells you, everything. All of this is distortion. All of it. And fixation and holding to any of it as more real and more true than anything else, this is the second fetter. And interestingly enough, the second fetter actually leads to the third fetter, which is doubt. All forms of doubt. Self-doubt. Doubt in wisdom. Doubt in the ability for the open-hearted practice of compassion to actually have an impact. It actually has an impact, trust me, because there is no separation. When you practice metta, everything, you are touching everything else with metta. Oh, sure, you may be a drop in the bucket. After all, there's 9 billion people on the planet. However, to think that this is just some mind game that doesn't actually have any effect This is a distorted false view. Practice has an effect. It has an effect because there's one less human cultivating hatred and separation in the world. And that ripples out. So remembering these first three fetters is a very powerful way to practice in the midst of such horror. I was just about to say that clinging to the view of right and wrong is another distorted view. And then I realized, you know, Buddhism has been replete with translations of things like right view. I've never really been a fan of right view. I'm more of a fan of wise view because prajna or wisdom is the bottom line for everything. And when we say right view, right intention, actually, I believe that the Buddha was pointing at prajna, which is this sense of perfection in the capacity to always be taking your next step with wise view, with wisdom. All of these things I've just mentioned, all of them help us cultivate nonviolence. There are many things that could be happening right now. There are many ways in which the devastating actions of Hamas could be met. In some way, it feels similar. I'm having a similar feeling that I had after 9/11. When we were at a choice point, it really was a choice point at that moment. There were more than one path, and the path that was chosen was not a wise path because it, well, for so many reasons, but in general, utterly lacked any capacity to go beyond blame and hatred and greed. In fact, everything we did, everything our government did was rooted in hatred and greed and ignorance. There's some way in which this is a shining moment where a path could be taken other than just more violence and retribution. It could be. It won't be. And partly, I think this is because the Middle East, honestly, has been a trauma vortex for 5,000 years or more. And it's almost impossible. Really, it's almost impossible There was one man. I don't know if any of you remember Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin was on the path of wise view, and he was taking Israel on that path. And the person who stopped Yitzhak Rabin was Israeli, because that person could not tolerate a path that looked different than hatred, greed, and ignorance. And ever since then, Israel and the Palestinians have suffered. So it's not enough to say, I'm in anguish and I'm heartbroken. It is not enough. As practitioners, it is on us to walk the path of prajna, of wisdom, to walk the path of fierce compassion, not namby-pamby compassion. Compassion, using compassion to feel okay. This is not compassion. This is not compassion. So I very much want to remind you all, I think I've read this before, but I feel compelled to read this again. And I know sometimes when I teach all of you, sometimes I stray from the Theravada path. However, there are three turnings of the wheel, and they are all the Buddhist teachings, and they are all imbued with the highest prajna. On the other hand, the view is a little different in each of these vehicles. But I really, really, I want to stress to all of you, in order to find the path of prajna and fierce compassion, we have to understand what it means to be a bodhisattva. And even though the Buddha, the historical Buddha, I mean, they say the Buddha was a bodhisattva. This is in the Theravada. The Theravada said that the Buddha had thousands of lives as a bodhisattva until the point where he got to the lifetime where he was able to achieve enlightenment. That is the Theravada talking. However, you know, the Buddha didn't teach the bodhisattva path. He taught the path, the arhat path. You know, you go, you wake up, you alleviate suffering, that's it. Not how do you live in the world and find a way to be in a world so full of anguish and suffering. How do we do this? It's fine to leave the world and go follow the path of your own enlightenment. If you are going to stay in the world, it's going to be the bodhisattvic path. It has to be, because it's not possible to stomach the level of ignorance and greed and hatred without having your own ignorance, hatred, and greed toward the ignorance, hatred, and greed. So I'm going to, one more time, I'm going to read from the Prajna Paramita Sutta, which is from the Mahayana, but this is the ultimate text on the bodhisattvic view, how a bodhisattva lives in the world and dedicates themselves to the awakening of all beings everywhere, no matter what suffering they're perpetrating. That is the bodhisattvic path. So I'm going to just read a few things. This is out of my textbook, but to understand what it means to be a bodhisattva in the world, I used a quote from Lex Hickson's book on Prajnaparamita. It's an excellent translation of the Prajnaparamita with really fantastic commentary. It's from 1993, that book. He writes, although bodhisattva sounds like a non-ordinary being, they are humans dedicated to living selflessly and lovingly in the ordinary world. Bodhisattvas earn an honest living or receive the gift of sustenance in some way that serves and elevates beings, rather than in any way which would exploit or corrupt them. These diamond beings interrelate with people in ways which are harmonious rather than argumentative, serving rather than demanding. So this is his view of what it means to live in the world as a householder and with the bodhisattva view of dedicating everything we do to the awakening of all beings everywhere. This is possible for a bodhisattva because a bodhisattva holds a view of emptiness that is quite special. The Prajnaparamita Sutta is basically a gathering of beings with the Buddha. And it is a conversation that two very special beings have. One of the beings is Subhuti. And there's some super interesting things that he says to this gathering of beings. And he is speaking in the request of the Buddha himself. The Buddha asks Subhuti to clarify for the gathering of beings how a bodhisattva goes forth with wisdom. And at this point in the text, Subhuti's words, they are understood to be direct transmission of the Buddha's mind, not something Subhuti is coming up with on his own. So it is as though these words are being spoken by the Buddha. So Subhuti says the following. Since I neither find nor apprehend nor see a Dharma Bodhisattva, nor a with perfect wisdom, what bodhisattva shall I instruct in what perfect wisdom? And yet, if when this is pointed out, a bodhisattva does not despair or despond, he does not turn away, he's not terrified or frightened, it is just this bodhisattva, this great being, who should be instructed in wisdom. It is precisely this that should be recognized as wisdom. When the bodhisattva thus stands firmly, he should so train himself that he does not pride himself on that thought of enlightenment. That thought is no thought, since in its essential transparent nature, that thought is transparently luminous. It is the transparent luminosity of all phenomena, all existent phenomena, including Hamas. Hamas, like everything else, is transparent lucidity. This is the view of the bodhisattva. That is the wisdom. Human beings have great capacity to cause harm through their utter lack of understanding of the way things truly are. This is the core of the Buddhist teachings. If you can take this to heart, you can open your heart fully to any human, no matter how severe the suffering they cause. Because ultimately, they are nothing more than transparent luminosity. And because they're in a human body, they have innate capacity to awaken to it, even though it may be the last thing they will ever do. This is the view. When you turn the jewel of the mind, there's nothing to hate. Ultimately, there is only suffering to alleviate. That is the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva sees the innate transparent luminosity of all phenomena. That is how the bodhisattva is able to live freely, wisely, open-heartedly in the world of suffering. And it doesn't matter how hard we think it is. The luminosity is always there. It's never not there. So it's not enough to say, I'm in anguish, because it doesn't alleviate suffering. We must take it upon ourselves to walk the path of wisdom. No matter what, to never in any way, shape, or form cultivate hatred. Do not see anything as me and mine. And to understand we all suffer, all of us. And our suffering, it's all the same. It's just distortion in the view. Some people are more distorted than others, and they cause horrific harm. And yet, those very people still have the ability to awaken. The highest wisdom is not to take sides, and it is the hardest path. And not to get lost in anguish. That is merely empathic distress. Compassion has no distress. Compassion only knows distress, but it is not imbued with distress. Anyone else have anything they would like to offer? My wish is that this was in some way helpful.